This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant is scheduled to close in 2019, but there are many who would like to see it shut down sooner. That leaves a significant gap in southern New England's energy supply, and love it or hate it, nuclear power is a source of electricity that doesn't contribute to global warming. The public debate about the role of nuclear power often centers around the safety records of existing power plants, like Pilgrim, but those facilities are quite frankly old. Decades old. Which made us here at Living Lab wonder if we're having an outdated debate. What if there's an idea, a new technology out there that could completely change the conversation about nuclear power? Like, say, mobile miniature reactors or offshore floating nuclear power. That's where we start today with Jacopo Buongiorno. He's the TEPCO professor and associate department head for nuclear science and engineering at MIT. He's also director of the Center for Advanced Nuclear Energy Systems. Professor Buongiorno, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant is 45 years old. And according to the federal government, the average age of a commercial reactor in the U.S. is 36 years old. How much has nuclear technology changed in the four decades since most of these plants went online?
It hasn't changed much in a sense that those are the plants that we built several decades ago. The plants are old indeed, but I would caution against calling them aged facilities. With the exception of a couple of components that are not economically replaceable, such as the reactor vessel and the containment building, many other components, systems, subsystems, have actually been well-maintained or even completely replaced at all our nuclear power plants. So they tend to be very reliable machines in spite of their venerable age.
It's one of those situations, like if you've replaced every part of your car, is it actually still the same car that you bought 200,000 miles ago?
Yes and no. The design is still the same, but again, in terms of reliability and performance, the plants are really good. The main reason why many plants are struggling around the country, especially in deregulated electricity markets, is because they're not making money. So it's not really an issue with the age of the facility. It's more the fact that the power markets right now are such that nuclear power plants are not economically competitive.
I mean, you say the technology hasn't changed much, but Pilgrim is what's known as first-generation technology. A plant being built today would be, I think, third-generation technology, and there's kind of a fourth generation being developed. So what changes from first generation to third generation? Is it, you know, new cooling systems, better containment, or are we talking about potentially really revamping how nuclear reactors work?
So that's a very good question, and we have to distinguish between Generation 3 and Generation 4. Generation 3 are essentially evolutionary designs of the first designs that we built 30, 40 years ago. So they're still water-cooled reactors, either pressurized water reactors or boiling water reactors. Fundamentally, it's the same technology. Of course, the design has evolved for the better in some senses. For example, the Generation 3 systems tend to be passively safe, or at least some designs are passively safe, which means you do not rely on AC power, on external source of power, during an emergency to provide the cooling that the reactor requires. So in that sense, they are better, I guess, than what we built 30 or 40 years ago. If you now go to Generation 4 systems, that's a radical innovation. And so in that sense, yes, that technology is very, very new, but keep in mind that we have not built Generation 4 systems yet. We've built some prototypes in the past couple of decades, and there is a lot of interest now in the U.S., but especially overseas, in China in particular, where they're pushing on Generation 4 technologies a lot more than we are in this country.
So what do those look like? Are they something that we would still recognize as being a nuclear reactor? How radical are these innovations?
So in what really changes the design radically in a nuclear reactor is when you change the coolant. All the commercial nuclear power plants that we operate in the U.S. are water-cooled, and the use of water as a coolant forces you down a certain design path. And if you change from water to a different coolant, for example, a gas as a coolant, either helium or CO2 or a liquid metal or a molten salt or many different options, then the design changes radically, because what changes is the operating conditions, things like pressure and the temperature of the reactor, as well as the fuel, the nuclear fuel that would be compatible with that coolant and so on. So all these generation four systems tend to be, I would say, generally safer, in a sense that the probability of having an accident is much lower. But perhaps more important or more interesting from an economic point of view, they tend to be more efficient because they use coolants that allow you to operate at higher temperatures. And according to the laws of thermodynamics, higher temperature means higher efficiency of conversion, of converting heat into electricity. So that's the main benefit, I would say, enhanced safety and then enhanced economics. That's really why we're pursuing, these Gen 4 systems.
In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with Jacopo Buongiorno. He's a professor of nuclear engineering at MIT. One, I would say, radical idea that you've put forward is this idea of a floating offshore nuclear power plant. I mean, you say it's basically a conventional reactor on a modified oil rig. What's the attraction to trying to take nuclear offshore?
Yeah, so the main impetus for that idea comes from the desire to reduce the capital cost of a new nuclear power plant, okay? So the cost of installation. And traditionally, nuclear power plants are built on, of course, on land, and they follow a model that we call a stick build. So essentially, small parts of the reactor are brought to the site, and then they're all assembled at the site, and there is a lot of civil work that takes place at the site, excavations and foundations and things of that type. And it's that part of a nuclear construction project that costs a lot of money. So what we want to do is to integrate a nuclear reactor inside a platform so that the whole plant could be built in a shipyard. A shipyard is a controlled environment which is extremely efficient at building large facilities in a short period of time and at lower cost than you would do at a site. So the main value proposition for this concept is to deliver a nuclear power plant at lower cost and more rapidly than a traditional plant.
I have to say, I find it surprising that something offshore would actually be cheaper. We so frequently hear things about how, for example, offshore wind energy is so much more expensive than land-based wind energy. So that's somewhat surprising. And I guess my first instinct had been, well, going offshore, the draw would be you're farther away from people. That must be safer. Is safety a factor?
Yes, it's. I would say that the second motivation for looking at this design is safety. The first is economics, and you're right, it is a little bit counterintuitive that going offshore would be cheaper, but for the reasons that I just explained, it does promise a lower cost plant. As far as safety is concerned, you said it correctly. Having a little bit more distance between the power plant and population centers is a plus. For terrestrial plants, there is an emergency planning zone, which is a 10-mile radius around the station. Anyone within that radius has to be periodically trained for a potential, hypothetical, and very rare emergency situation. They would have to evacuate, or they may be asked to evacuate, and so on. So with an offshore plant, essentially you would have no resident population within that emergency planning zone, so that's certainly an advantage. Also, being in the ocean, you have easy access to a heat sink, as we say. The ocean water itself can be used for cooling the reactor. Now, we have to be clear. I'm not suggesting, or we're not proposing that you use seawater inside the reactor. Actually, seawater never comes in contact with the nuclear fuel. It never becomes radioactive or anything, but you can essentially transfer the heat that is generated in the reactor to the ocean through heat exchangers, and that process can be done very reliably. And again, as we say, passively, which means without any external intervention. So it does actually make for a very safe design.
What about in the, as you said, rare and hypothetical eventuality, which we saw several years ago was not so hypothetical in Fukushima, that something goes wrong? I mean, you're 10 miles out in the ocean. There's no backup power. There's no infrastructure around to help out at that point. So what happens then?
Yeah, so the point number one, you don't need the backup power. In fact, so we're designing it so that it's completely intrinsically safe, that you don't need any sort of a form of backup power. And number two, we're also designing it to have many redundant barriers between the nuclear fuel, which is where the radioactivity is generated, if you wish, and the environment. So according to the our analysis and so on, even under the most catastrophic potential accidents, you would not have a release of radioactivity into the environment. So again, we think that the safety case is very, very strong.
How would you get people out there to work on it? How many people versus, you know, how much automation would you build into something like an offshore nuclear plant so that you didn't have to be, you know, flying people or ferrying people 10 miles out to sea and back?
Yeah, that's a very important point because obviously people that workers that would work on a platform would the cost of labor, let's put it that way, would be higher, and therefore there is a strong incentive in reducing the number of operators. So we are looking at ways to automate operation as much as possible, but you know, realistically, you will need to have operators on the platform. And correctly, as you said, you would not be able to bring them in and out on a daily basis. It would cost a lot, and it would be very inconvenient for the operators as well. And so we're using the same model that is used by offshore oil and gas platforms, where essentially you have workers that stay on the platform for, say, 2 to 3 weeks, and then they are off for 2 or 3 weeks. And you know, go back home and do whatever they want to do. So we're adopting a little bit of a different, operations model with respect to the terrestrial plants, where people live nearby and they come in and out of the plant on a daily basis. Here, they would stay on the platform for a little bit longer. But our analysis shows that in the end, between automation and this model, you should be at the same, more or less, the same operation and maintenance cost of a terrestrial plant.
One issue that both the shutdown of Pilgrim Nuclear and some of the problems they've had in the past couple of years has really brought to the forefront of people's minds around here is, what do you do with the waste, both as you're operating and once you're done with a plant? So how would you handle waste, radioactive material? You're not going to presumably have cooling ponds 10 miles out to sea. What do you do with the waste?
So the same that is done on terrestrial plants, in the U.S., all the nuclear power plants essentially have accumulated their spent nuclear fuel, which is what you're referring to as waste, on the site. And so this is kept within spent nuclear fuel pools, just, you know, pools filled with water. And it stays there for a few years until it cools down enough, and then it's put into dry casks. And I think even at Pilgrim, they have dry casks. So these are fully contained canisters in which you put your spent fuel, and then it just sits there. Now, ultimately, of course, it has to be taken to a centralized repository, but this is a national debate now. Where is it going to be? 30 years ago, the U.S. government decided that it should be in a place called Yucca Mountain in Nevada, but that is not, you know, that posture has not happened, mostly because of the opposition by Nevadans. But as far as the offshore floating nuclear plant is concerned, it would be the same approach. So you would have a built-in spent nuclear fuel pool that would accumulate your spent nuclear fuel there, and then ultimately transfer to dry casks, and then transfer to a central repository.
China and Russia have both announced some plans to build floating nuclear plants. The U.S., I believe, actually did build one about 50 years ago that powered the locks in the Panama Canal for a period. Are there any new ones in the works at this point?
No. Offshore floating nuclear power plants in the U.S. Are not being built now. As you correctly said, Russia and China have announced plans to build them. Actually, Russia has been in the process of doing so for a while. The Chinese have come to that game only about, I think, a year ago, but they seem to be actually more serious than the Russia, and they also seem to have more resources to do it. So my bet is that the Chinese will get to an offshore floating plant sooner than the Russians. Here in the U.S., besides our project, which started at MIT, and so it was a university project, I don't think there is anybody else that is seriously considering offshore floating nuclear plants.
What do you think is holding back nuclear development in the United States? I mean, there are other countries, France, for that matter, even Japan, that get a significant portion of their energy from nuclear. You've mentioned the economics. Do they have a different economic model, or is it simply a matter of a different public opinion about nuclear in other countries?
So the first thing I would point out is that even in the U.S., while we're not building a lot of new nuclear power plants, the existing fleet supplies about 20% of our electricity. So it's already an important industrial reality in the U.S. Now, the question is, why aren't we building a lot more, right? And I would say the most important challenge to nuclear power plants these days is economics. The main reason why we're not building them is that they're just not economically competitive. And it's a combination of reasons. The first is that natural gas prices in the U.S. are very, very low. So the competition to nuclear is very cheap. And then regionally, for example, in the Midwest, there is a lot of wind capacity, and which comes online sometimes when you need it, but sometimes when you don't need it, right? It's intermittent. It's random. Whenever the wind blows, you get that electricity. And if you have a mismatch between supply and demand, if you have too much supply and not enough demand, the prices of electricity collapse, and baseload generators such as nuclear power plants essentially are not profitable in those regions when that happens. So it is really an economic reason. If you look at China, it's a combination of things. They have a lot of coal fire power plant capacity, and that's causing not just a lot of emissions in terms of CO2, but it's also causing terrible local pollution problems. If you've ever been to Beijing or Shanghai, it's the air is borderline unbreathable. It's just terrible. And a lot of that pollution comes from coal power plants. So in their case, there is a desire to clean their air, and that's why they're pushing nuclear. But in the long term, even in China, if nuclear is not going to be economically competitive with coal or natural gas and so on, people are going to look elsewhere. So the big challenge that we have as nuclear community and nuclear industry is to make sure that the next generation or the next plants that we're going to build are going to be economically competitive with the alternatives.
That's nuclear energy expert Jacopo Buongiorno of MIT. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
I'm Heather Goldstone. We'll have another bold idea for the future of nuclear when Living Lab continues after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're talking today about the future of nuclear power. We just heard from a professor at MIT who is designing an offshore nuclear power plant. And later, we'll talk to a safety expert from the Union of Concerned Scientists. Right now, we turn to an innovator with a different approach for the future of nuclear. Jose Reis is the co-founder and chief technology officer at NuScale Power. He's also co-designer of the company's small modular nuclear power plant. He joins me now by Skype from NuScale in Corvallis, Oregon. Jose Reis, welcome to Living Lab.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
All right, when we say small nuclear reactor, give me a sense, how small are we actually talking?
So our design is a 50 megawatt electric reactor. So each module will produce 50 megawatts electric. So in comparison, the large plants today are about 1,000 megawatts. So it's a much smaller in size. There's some real advantages to that because we can actually build these small modules in a factory. And that includes the reactor vessel and the containment vessel. So you're accustomed to seeing the large concrete containment domes that have been built historically. We've eliminated that and gone to a very small, high-strength steel containment with about 10 or more times the pressure rating capability.
And does that help avoid some of the safety problems that we're seeing with older reactors like Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station, which is near us here on Cape Cod?
Yeah, it's interesting. This design is what we call passively safe. So each of the modules is inserted in a pool. So basically, the design is a reactor inside of a steel containment, underwater, underground. And so that's the whole concept. It's relatively simple, and we can put 12 modules in a single plant. So you can add them as power is required. In terms of safety, what it does for us is that everything you need for safety is right there. In the pool. We don't need any external water, external pumps or piping. And this plant will cool itself for an indefinite period of time without any operator action, no AC or DC power, and no need to add any additional water. And it'll do that for, again, an unlimited period of time. So it really represents a different level of safety in the designs.
And how does it do that? How does it cool itself indefinitely?
Oh, yeah. So, you know, one of the things that passive safety allows is that we're using the laws of physics, basically, gravity and natural convection, conduction through walls to do all the heat transfer. So that means there's no power required for cooling. So what I've done is I've taken a reactor with a relatively small heat source, 160 megawatts thermal, and put this inside of a containment. And when you shrink things down, what happens is the surface area in a cylinder, the surface area to volume really grows significantly. So that means we have a lot of surface area for heat removal with a relatively small amount of thermal input. So natural convection, just the motion of the water against the outside of the containment shell, just by temperature difference, provides enough heat transfer to remove all the decay heat of a nuclear reactor.
The first time I ever encountered the idea of making a smaller nuclear reactor, it was actually in the context of somebody saying, well, then you could put a small reactor on the back of an 18-wheeler truck and you could move this reactor around from place to place. It could be a mobile reactor that could go wherever power was needed, whenever power was needed. Is that an idea that has ever occurred to you?
Well, that certainly is something that has been around for a while. In the 50s and 60s, there were some concepts on the military side, army bases and remote locations, where they were considering things like that. Our design is more centralized. Well, it is a centralized design. And the modules are pretty big. So they're 70 feet long. So it's a lot smaller than a conventional nuclear power plant, but still pretty large. And they're 15 feet in diameter. So they can be transported primarily by barge, and in some parts of the country by rail, and of course by truck. But we don't provide any fuel when we're transporting. The fuel is only inserted at the location where you're actually producing the power. So that's kind of our approach.
Now, the other thing you mentioned about your design is this idea of being modular, that you can kind of keep adding these small units to essentially build a power plant that produces as much as the larger reactors that we currently have. So what is the benefit of being modular like that?
Well, the flexibility it offers is really enormous. The whole concept has evolved over time because of our interactions with the utility customers. So we have a board of utility members who, about 26, who participate in our regular board meetings, that they all have a fleet that includes coal-fired plants. They also include wind and other renewables. And so they're looking for some realistic answers to their concerns with regards to retiring of some of the aging coal-fired plants. So this model fits very well with retirement of these coal-fired plants. So, for example, the first customer, the Utah Associated Municipal Power Systems, what we're planning to do there in that first plant, which we're hoping will go operational in 2026, is we'll insert up to 12 modules in that location. And we can start off with one or two modules and then add additional modules over time. But that gives them some flexibility as they retire one coal fire plant, 170 to 300 megawatts electric, or a second plant, or even larger, you know, 500 megawatt plants. With those retirements, we can add modules as modules are needed. So cost-wise, it makes a big difference.
You mentioned going online with this plant that you're in the process of building, going online 2026. If you look back, actually, through news coverage of this idea and this plant's development, I mean, there was, in 2009, a story saying that it would be built this year in 2017. So I wonder why it takes so long to build a nuclear power plant and why it's been pushed back almost a decade at this point.
Yeah, if you look at what it takes to develop the design certification application and get the regulatory review in place. So we started our interactions with the regulator in 2008. So we've actually been 8 years into pre-application phase with the regulator. And what that does is it allows them to see what the differences are in our design, identify gaps in regulation that need to be changed because of our design being different. And it allows us to do all of our testing. So we've done about $40 million worth of testing of full-scale components to make sure that this design is safe and will function properly. But the scope of work, I think it's difficult to judge when you're going through it for the first time. So we've expended over $500 million up to this point to be able to submit our design certification application. So there's a lot of funds that have been expended. It's about 2 million labor hours to produce to get to this point to produce our design certification application to submit, and about 800 people working on this. So it's a pretty large endeavor when you first look at it and you actually evolve through it and you realize all the things that need to be done to demonstrate the safety of the plant.
And where does the money and the manpower come from when this is the first one that you're trying to get built?
Well, you know, we have a great strategic partner in Fluor Corporation. So Fluor is a very large engineering procurement construction firm. And they're in 66 countries, and they have about 60,000 employees, and they've been building nuclear power plants for over some time. So they have a lot of experience, their view is certainly very supportive, and they've been our lead investor up to this point. So having a strategic partner who's looking forward to build these plants is really essential. The other partner, of course, is the Department of Energy. So we competed and we successfully got a grant, a matching grant, for $217 million. So that was huge for the company and was essential. That's really an important role for government. When you're coming up with a new design and you need to go through all those the first-of-a-kind type things, that's essential.
You mentioned earlier that you see the modular design in part coming into play as, say, coal-fired plants are gradually shut down, that you can gradually ramp up nuclear. I wonder if you have sensed any change in the past couple of months from your partners at the Department of Energy, from federal regulators, about the future of nuclear as President Trump has come into office and has said he wants to bring back coal. Do you get a sense of any kind of policy shift at the federal level in regards to nuclear?
Yeah, certainly. At this point, we really haven't seen a change. Now that that we have a new Department of Energy secretary, I think we'll start understanding what that process might look like in the future. But I think we've historically had bipartisan support for moving forward with our design. I think the view is that this the flexibility that this design offers, the reduced cost. And the safety is fairly significant, so we're still waiting to see. We think that we'll proceed in the way that we have been in the past. But at this point, the big thing for us is that we've submitted our design certification application here in January. It was the 17th was the official date that was received, and then there's a 60-day clock. So the NRC is reviewing the application for acceptance. And hopefully, any day now, we'll find out if we need to submit more information or if the application is complete for them to dock it and begin their formal review. So we're moving forward. We haven't slowed down. We have our funding for this year that we're looking at, and by the time we're done with this project, we will have spent about $1 billion.
Wow, the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station here in New England is actually closing down in 2019. Because of largely market pressures, cheap natural gas, and it's just becoming too expensive to operate a nuclear power plant. As you're looking forward in the next decade or so at the energy landscape, do you see a need for changes in order for nuclear to be more viable? Or do you think you have a viable path forward for nuclear with the economic pressures that are existing today?
Yeah, we at this point, you know, we are competing with natural gas and with wind and other forms of energy there. Natural gas being kind of the biggest competitor at this point. What we find is that in certain parts of the country, we are competitive. So UAMPS, for example, our Utah's just Associated Municipal Power Systems, they are looking very closely at us because of the fact that for them, it's not so much the price of gas at the hub, but if you include the cost of transporting the gas to the burner tip, there's an additional cost there. And they've experienced a lot of volatility with gas prices in the past. So they're looking for something long-term that's highly reliable, that will provide them also grid stability. So they also have wind power. And our design also does what's called load following. So we can complement renewables like wind power or the variable solar so that the grid remains stable. This is something that we haven't done in nuclear in the past. But because we have small modules with relatively small turbines, we can actually do some very effective load following with wind and with solar. So that makes it very attractive, and it provides other features besides just the economic benefit. There's some things that we should apply value to in terms of a base load or grid stability that we really haven't valued in the past.
At various points in your career, you've been a professor at Oregon State. You've worked at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. How did you come to found and run a company that's looking to build nuclear power plants?
Yeah, it's been an interesting career path. What happened was, you know, in 2000, I had a grant from the Department of Energy to look at a reactor concept, and was looking at small reactors. By 2003, we had a really great concept, but as most academics, you say, well, that project's done, let's go on to the next thing. But what really convinced me of the need to have this technology out in the market was I spent a year working with the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna, and I started socializing this idea of small reactors, and in particular what my design that I've been working on. And what I found was that there was a huge market for this. There are many places that don't have the capital for the large 1,000 megawatt plants, or they have very small grids. They just can't accommodate 1,000 megawatts. So when I came back to the States in 2005, I asked myself, well, we have this great test facility. We had built a 1/3 scale prototype. Let's take this from the lab to the market. How hard could that be? Well, it's a lot of work. Here we are 10 years later. It's an enormous amount of work, but it certainly has been worth it.
Jose Reyes is co-founder and chief technology officer at NuScale Power. We spoke by Skype. Jose, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Up next, we talk to a nuclear safety expert from the Union of Concerned Scientists. Living Lab continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We've heard two, quite frankly, pretty wild ideas for where nuclear power could go in the future. Just how realistic are they, though? And even if we did pursue them, what would we do with the dozens of aging nuclear power plants we already have? We turn now to David Lochbaum. He has worked as a nuclear engineer at power plants for 17 years and spent another 20 analyzing them for the Union of Concerned Scientists. He's followed the problems at Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station closely, and he joins us now. David, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you for having me on.
What about this idea that we heard earlier this hour of building an offshore nuclear power plant, a floating power plant? This is an idea coming from MIT. I mean, does this seem realistic and safe to you?
Yes. In fact, it's been an idea that's been around for a while and has actually been in practice. My father worked for Westinghouse back in the 70s, and they were in a joint venture to develop floating nuclear power plants for use here in the United States. They actually sold a couple to a utility in New Jersey that would have been anchored just offshore from Atlantic City, but at that time those plants were canceled because there was too much electricity in the marketplace didn't support them. But both here and in Russia, Russia's developing or currently building a floating nuclear power plant, and they're not that far removed from the power plants that power our nuclear submarines and nuclear surface ships. So the idea is feasible, and it's actually progressed beyond just the drawing board.
I mean, you mentioned that the initial attempts in the United States really didn't go anywhere because of a lack of demand. Clearly, we have a lot of demand for power, and in some places, like right here in southeastern Massachusetts, are looking at potential gaps in our power supply. So what's the state of this now? I mean, do you think that there would be enough market demand to start looking at offshore nuclear power realistically?
It could be, because one of the things that's often also coupled with floating nuclear power plants is that they tend to be smaller scaled or smaller sized than the nuclear power plants land-based plants that we've operated here in the United States. The advantage of a smaller reactor is
there's a smaller energy gap that you're trying to close. So it's easier to project that and accurately fill that gap.
What do you mean by an energy gap?
Well, when you try to forecast what electricity needs will be 5 years down the road, and that's hard to forecast. There's a lot of uncertainty with that. If you build a large plant, you have to accurately forecast a large need. If you are over-optimistic and you don't need electricity, like the plants off Atlantic City did, you don't need the power plant. Whereas it's easier to forecast a smaller energy need and build a plant to meet that need.
Well, speaking of smaller power plants, that's the other idea for the future of nuclear that we've heard, which is the company NuScale and their idea of building small kind of modular power plants. So what do you think about that idea?
Well, the advantage to that idea is that as you build the first one or two small nuclear plants, you start bringing revenue in. They start making electricity, start generating revenue, and that then provides the cash flow to build the third, fourth, fifth, and so on. Rather than trying to build one large power plant that has the overall same capacity, and then you don't get any revenue until you fully built the power plant. And construction costs for nuclear power plants tend to be higher than for non-nuclear facilities. So anything you do that helps your cash flow and allows you to finance the remaining construction is a benefit.
Why is it that nuclear power plants are so expensive to build? I mean, does it have to do with the nuclear fuel, or what else is driving up that cost?
A large part of it is the regulations that require a lot of safety features and backup safety features. And another huge cost is concrete. These power plants, nuclear power plants, need a lot of concrete for shielding and to support the weight of a lot of the safety equipment. Concrete is surprisingly expensive, and it's a large share of the construction costs for nuclear power plants.
That's pretty amazing. I mean, when you consider all of the technology that has to go into a nuclear power plant, it's plain old concrete that's really making these plants almost so expensive that they can't be built.
I heard that once and have checked it several times since then because I didn't believe it the first time. But I've heard it enough now that I'm starting to believe it.
Well, and it seems that the financial pressures on existing nuclear power generators has also intensified in recent years. I mean, presumably a plant like Pilgrim Nuclear that is, 45 years old, they hopefully have paid off their construction costs, and yet the leading reason that Entergy has cited in wanting to close down the plant is finances. So what has changed in recent years to put nuclear at such a financial disadvantage, even in terms of operating costs?
Well, two things happened to drive up nuclear power's costs, and one thing happened to make non-nuclear competitors cheaper. On the cost side, Fukushima happened about 6 years ago, and the companies are spending millions of dollars to implement the safety upgrades that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission required as a result of that disaster. At the same time, the nuclear power plants are getting older, and therefore a lot of the pipes and gaskets and motors need to be refurbished or replaced so that they maintain the necessary safety margins, so that the care and feeding costs are going up as the plants get older. On the other side of the coin, natural gas fracking has lowered the cost of some of the competitors to nuclear power. So when you have rising costs and lowering costs on your competitors, that's put you in a bind.
And what about renewable energy? I mean, we often hear a lot about how much, say, offshore wind or solar, how much more expensive that is than conventionally generated electricity. But at the same time, we've been seeing the costs of those renewables coming down, perhaps almost to a competitive rate. So how does that affect nuclear?
That's been a problem for nuclear power. The solar prices, new renewables like solar and wind, prices are coming down. And at the same time, nuclear power plant costs are going up. In fact, one of the problems that the nuclear industry faced was they've been very successful in renewing the life of the existing plants. More than 75% of our nuclear power plants have gotten 20-year extensions. That success meant that you delayed needing large new generating stations. And so that put off, that delayed that need for replacements at a time when renewables were basically gave time for renewables to catch up. The nuclear industry hadn't been so successful renewing the life of their existing plants, they would have had to been replaced. at a time when renewables was more expensive, and perhaps that would have favored new nuclear power and construction, but that time has passed.
Well, let's talk about those renewals. I mean, as you said, Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station got a renewal for 20 years. And since the time that that renewal came through, it has been ranked by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission as one of the three worst plants in the country. Many unplanned shutdowns, lots of safety concerns. So, you know, when we talk about these existing plants and the fact that we don't, as you just said, need new nuclear, I mean, is that really true? Are these plants really something that we can continue to operate?
Most of the nuclear power plants in the United States are old, but their management is facing those challenges well. Many of the plants are in regulated electricity marketplaces, so as long as they convince the state public utility commission it's a prudent expense, they can pay for the refurbishments or replacements and continue to generate electricity economically. In some states, like Massachusetts, deregulation has meant that nuclear power plants are competing head-to-head with other sources that may not have the costs of fixing Fukushima and so on. And that made the situation at Pilgrim tough for its owner. It's not a showstopper. It just means the owner has to prioritize what gets done today and what gets deferred until later. And that was a problem that faced many plants in the Northeast. The Vermont Yankee plant shut down in the recent years. The Kewaunee plant in Wisconsin was also put out of business by relatively cheap natural gas. So it's a challenge. You know, even the best juggler can get too many balls up in the air, and that seems to have been a problem that caused Pilgrim to decide to shut down early rather than use its 20-year extension.
Well, in recognition of the many problems that Pilgrim has been having, in January, nuclear regulators held a public meeting to talk about the safety violations. You were there. What did you learn from that meeting?
Well, that meeting was to discuss a special inspection the NRC did at Pilgrim. Pilgrim is, as you noted, one of the three worst nuclear power plants in the country. It's in what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission calls its column four of a five-column report card, if you will.
What would the fifth column be?
The fifth column is you're shut down until you fix the safety problems to the NRC's satisfaction. The other option was that you've made enough improvements to start working your way back into column three or column two. It looks like from that meeting that Pilgrim is going to stay in column four. The good news is for the company is that it's not going to be moved into column five and have to shut down. Some of the community thought perhaps it should, but the NRC hasn't found that evidence.
Well, Entergy is, of course, going to be shutting the plant down altogether within the next couple of years. They've said, though, I mean, that's not going to be the end of the story. They've said it could take up to 60 years to decommission. But another company has said, hey, we could come in, we could shut it down in something more like a decade. And apparently the difference between those two estimates is a program called SafeStore. So what is SafeStore and how would it work at Pilgrim?
SafeStore is one of the options that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission permits. The idea is to basically postpone decommissioning or dismantling the plant for 60 years. During that time, a lot of the radioactivity is decayed away. So you still have a radioactive material to deal with, but you have a smaller volume, and therefore it's less of a risk to workers and less of a cost for owners. The flip side of that is the radioactive material has to be shipped to special landfills, and the landfills that are available today may not be available 60 years from now. So the other companies are arguing that we'll eliminate that uncertainty, take care of your problem in about a decade if you're willing to pay for it.
Well, and, you know, you're mentioning where the waste goes. Long term, what are the prospects for having a centralized repository for spent fuel or waste? This has been an issue for decades. Are we ever going to have such a thing, do you think?
I believe we will. And I think the reason we're doing that is more and more people are becoming disenchanted with the status quo. The plant owners don't like it because they continue to pay money for a service that the government was supposed to take away years ago. The communities don't like it. They'd like to go on to whatever the life for that community is after nuclear. We aren't satisfied with the safety and security risk being higher than they could be otherwise. So I think a lot of people want to see the status quo ended. The hard spot is that it costs money. So it literally takes an act of Congress to identify the funds that will be used to either centralized interim storage or a permanent repository. There have been bills introduced in Congress each of the last 5 or 6 years. Unfortunately, the House and the Senate don't agree on what that path is, but maybe this year, you know, there's always hope.
I think maybe you're more optimistic than I am about the prospects of getting Congress to agree on things this year.
Well, I think it's each year it's the gap between their two views has narrowed. I'm not even sure they're in the same book, let alone on the same page, but it is narrowing. So I think with more and more people pressuring Congress to take that next step, hopefully it will be taken sooner rather than later. Because the status quo isn't helping anybody. So hopefully that will be fixed.
Now, you've been talking about Congress at the federal level. Here in Massachusetts, legislators have filed a number of bills aimed specifically at Pilgrim. One would charge inactive nuclear plants up to $250,000 for radiation monitoring that would be conducted by the state. Another would charge $25 million a year to any plant that has shut down but not fully decommissioned within 5 years. Do you think these kinds of measures are necessary when it comes to Pilgrim?
Well, many states have provisions like that. Illinois and New Jersey, for example, have the first one you mentioned, the radiation monitoring around the plants. Those serve a purpose. Some states don't, so I'm not going to argue that it's the states are right, those states are wrong. I think it depends on the individual communities to make those decisions, and whatever the community decides is right for that area. But it has been done elsewhere, and it's at least a viable option in Massachusetts. The second one, the cost is, that one's a little difficult because you're somewhat stepping on federal turf. Certain things, the monitoring you can do without upsetting the big brother, but the second one is a little bit difficult. The state of Vermont tried something like that, and the federal government basically asked them to wander away.
You've mentioned the changes in the finances within the energy markets that over time have been making it increasingly difficult for nuclear to really be a viable option. But over the same time scale, we've been learning more and more about climate change. And so a new argument in favor of nuclear power has arisen, and that's the fact that power generation from nuclear is carbon neutral. There are no carbon dioxide emissions when you're making nuclear energy. So bottom line, when you look at this situation, do you think we have both the technology and also the public support that makes it likely that we actually will deploy nuclear on a scale that might affect the global climate?
I don't think so. Clearly, nuclear power does have some environmental benefits. It's a much smaller carbon footprint. But the price of that is too high. I mean, nuclear power is very expensive. We're seeing more nuclear plants shut down in the United States due to unfavorable economics than we're seeing being built. And the ones that are being built are way over budget. They're about $12 billion each, and that cost is rising. They're not done yet. So it's very difficult for Wall Street to free up the money or loan the money. And power companies, their market capitalization for companies that run these plants is less than $12 billion. So if you build a $12 billion plant, it doesn't turn out right, you've lost the company, and that's difficult for board of directors to take that much risk.
David Lockbaum is director of the Nuclear Safety Project at the Union of Concerned Scientists. David, thanks so much.
Thank you.
One final note this week. We're used to hearing about upcoming concerts and art exhibits. Well, this weekend, there's another option called Science on the Street. Think art or food festival, but with science instead. I spoke with the event's organizer, and you can find that conversation and information about the event on our website, capeandislands.org. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Until next week, this is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab is produced by Heather Goldstone and Elsa Partan. Mindy Todd is the executive producer. Major support for Living Lab comes from the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet.